Hello and welcome to another episode of At Random. My name's Rick Timmis.
And I'm John Wordsworth.
I'm Jackson Matthews. And today we are going to be looking at a whole bunch of stuff. To start with, we're going to start on a slightly more serious somber note and look at how and Steve Jobs' recent passing and how it's going to be affecting Apple in the future.
Peace, man.
That's right. Then we've got our usual app reviews, one each, and then we're going to be doing our plus ones, and we're going to be opening up a little this time. We're going to review a couple of books as well as a website, and finally, to see us out,
we're going to be looking at the Google Chrome App Store.
That's right. Yeah.
Take a look at that.
That's
and,
right. Yeah.
See what's going on.
Yeah, completely lost it for a moment there. Thank you, Rick.
You're welcome, Jack. We're always professional on this show.
It was my big moment as well to do the intro. And it turns out I needed stabilizers.
Well, I think that it's worthwhile starting off a little bit quietly. I think for me, a little bit quietly anyway on this one. I sort of wondered whether we should go for a minute's silence, but a minute's a heck of a long time on a podcast. But I think a few seconds silence is probably in order. Because, of course, obviously, Steve Jobs passed away in the last couple of days. And that's end of an era, I think, really. I mean, I think some amazing achievements. I'm not surprised, to be fair. I mean, he's had health issues for a long time.
I'm kind of surprised at how quickly it happened after he resigned. I didn't think he was quite as close as that. Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
I mean, I thought he was like, oh, yeah, I'm not cut out for anymore. And I didn't think he had that much longer left in him. But it did took me by surprise when I heard it. Put it that way. I mean, it kind of did and it didn't. I heard, I suppose, yeah, he was very sick, but like that was a bit quick. I expected like a year or so after him retiring, of him just lounging in the sun or whatever it was he was planning to do. But it felt sudden. It did feel sudden. Yeah.
I think there is that aspect to it. What were your thoughts on that, John?
Yeah, I think it took me by surprise as well. To be honest, I thought. I obviously realised things weren't going great for him when he stepped down, but I did think he was going to have a bit longer kicking back and enjoying the sun, like you say, before this time came. But
I kind of wasn't. I was the opposite. And I think it didn't surprise me at all that it's only been, in my mind, I mean, I'm not absolutely accurate, but in my mind it feels like it's only been about sort of 3 or 4 weeks since the announcement of him stepping down to him passing away. And that didn't surprise me at all. I'm reminded, or I think back to the days of Freddie Mercury, and when he died back in 1995, and the announcement of him kind of like effectively being ill came with only a few days before he was effectively announced that he'd died. You know what I mean? They said he was very ill at home and this and he was having problems and so on and so forth. And I think that comes about from people who have got incredibly strong characters. And Steve Jobs was an incredibly strong character. And, you know, in my mind, I was looking at this man, seeing him on the stage and seeing him doing his presentations and so on and so forth. And it wasn't that I was looking at him thinking, oh, he's dreadfully ill. I wasn't thinking that at all. He still struck me as an incredibly strong, vigilant man. And I think that he will have gone right. I figured that he would go right to the nail, holding the helm of Apple. You know, it was his life. It was, you know, what he'd done with that company was amazing. It was absolutely incredible. And I felt pretty sure that when he let go of the helm, it was probably because he just simply was not mentally or physically capable to do it anymore. And I suppose like anybody who's up for a big, huge kind of challenge like that, they're incredibly determined right to the very end.
No, that makes sense, yeah. When you've, like he knew he was on the verge, so to speak. So that's why he stepped down, I suppose. Yeah, that makes sense.
And but I think, you know, at the end of the day, for me, I think that some of the things that he's achieved in his life, he's responsible. I think in some ways almost single-handedly for the introduction of the kind of the home computer. You know, from the early days of the kind of shippable kits that he used to ship out of the garage that you would build yourself to. I mean, I cut my teeth on the Apple IIe when I went to college to do computer science. The network there was a series of networked Apple IIe computers running CPM. I learned on those machines and got very used to them. I remember the Mac coming out. I remember one of those within a couple of weeks of it being launched, being brought in. I can even remember the guy's name that brought it in, a ginger-haired lad who was a really good COBOL programmer. In fact, he was probably doing much better than me on the computer course overall. He was really, really knew his stuff. His father was big into computers as well. His name was Toby. And he brought this little box in and stuck it on the desk, and they connected the output, the screen output from it, to the projector. And that was the first time that I looked at this desktop paradigm with a little waste bin, and it was totally alien to me. I'd been used to looking at, you know, a command line interface, and any kind of interface that you would have used to interact with a machine was one you would build yourself, like a game or a little application. And to suddenly see this like desktop with these little icons you could click on, and I remember just being thinking, my God, this is an incredible monumental change. This all of a sudden means that no longer will people like me, who know a bit about computers, use computers. This will make it accessible to, you know, your mother-in-law or whatever. It was quite amazing to see that machine.
So what does it mean next then? How is this going to affect things, if at all?
Well,
is it going to affect the public's perception?
I personally think Apple's going to take a bit of a dip, but I don't necessarily think, I think they would have anyway. I think that they will be bigger without Steve Jobs. But I think they're reaching one of their peaks at the moment. And I think perhaps the iPad 3 is going to be their last little peak for a while. You sort of see with the iPhone 4S, they've run out of places to go at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And until they've gone a bit ahead of the standard technology curve, they've brought in some really interesting things. I don't think there's much left for them to put in there to create that wow factor. Obviously, I don't think they're going to dive or anything, but I just think that they've ridden out this curve. They brought out the iPad, and the iPhone's been doing great, and the App Store, and now the iPad 3 will come out soon, and I think that'll be a great hit. But then, obviously, Apple might pull something else out of their magic hat. But I just think
there's no doubt they'll have a long-term plan anyway.
That power that they're riding on, granted driven by Steve Jobs, I think is going to run out soon, and these other tablets are actually going to start making a dent, like with the Kindle tablet, which is coming out for like $200 for a colour tablet, which is dual core, and because they want to sell you Kindle books. I think these other tablets are finally going to start making a bit of a crack on Apple's market.
Because we'll see less in the way of genuine innovation, you think?
Yeah, I mean, like,
more mechanical.
Everyone was waiting for the iPhone generation. 5 and going, what's it going to have? And they went, I'm afraid there isn't an iPhone 5. It's just an iPhone 4 with a better camera. And everyone kind of went, where's Apple gone?
Yeah.
Sorry?
Apple
where's the real announcement?
Often, though, don't they? They do this, don't they? Like every two or three, they sort of bring out one that's just kind of like, if you can afford it, then buy it. But
I mean, if you're upgrading anyway,
yeah,
obviously you get it, but there's no pull at all as an iPhone 4 user for me to upgrade to the iPhone 4S. And I think the iPad 3 will be a big leap forward, because I hope that they're going to put the Retina display on the iPad.
Yeah.
So then you're going to have this kind of paper quality tablet, and then that'll beat back the Kindle.
Yeah.
So everyone will go, I'll get the Kindle because they're cheap, and then they'll say, but the iPad 3, it looks like paper.
Look at the
How's
pictures,
that for reading?
Yeah.
And everyone will go, oh, wow. But then I'm not sure where they're going to go. They'll make it more powerful and faster and better camera. But that will just catch up with all the Android tablets that are out there that already have a better camera and they're already dual core. And without the sort of power of Steve Jobs to sell this, the fashion of Apple, they're going to run out of substance as well soon.
I have a slightly slightly bolder position than that. And the first thing I'm going to say is that I think there are two kind of things at play here. When you head up an organisation like Steve Jobs has done, or if you look at what Bill Gates has done, for example, there are two things that can happen in an organisation. You can lead the organisation by being almost the sled puller, the person that will break the new ground and drive forward with new ideas. And I think Jobs has done that in Apple most definitely, and led from the front, and so has Bill Gates. But I think that in Apple's favour, and why I think this is, I think that they will be successful, but I think there is a caveat, and I think that their success will grow from here, is that it is one thing to lead an organisation and to show it the way forward, which leaves you being the leading light, and when you leave that organisation it becomes a little bit rudderless, and that has happened with Microsoft. In the case of Apple, there's a difference, and I think the difference is that with the passing of Steve Jobs and also his mental mindset, the type of person that he is, and also the fact that when you are staring death in the face, it focuses your mind really clearly into what your objectives are. And I think that Steve Jobs has managed to imprint the Jobs mentality into Apple. And so that means that Apple can still operate as a Jobs machine beyond him, because his attitude and aptitude is impregnated into the people and the staff at Apple. And until there is enough significant personnel change in Apple, which will probably take 3 years for a rolling program of natural wastage through a company to fall away, for the next 3 years it will still very much be the Jobs machine.
Sounds really sinister when you put it like that. Like, he's imprinted himself onto the staff and now it's the Jobs machine.
But I think that you know, that when you have such a pragmatic, determined leader like you have in Jobs, and something traumatic like this, you become emotionally connected to the company in a different way to just being an employee at Microsoft, working for making the Microsoft projects, to working for a company where its leader has gone through all of this trauma and so on and so forth. You will naturally subscribe to that as working for that enterprise. So that, I think, will enable the Jobs legacy for Apple to go further forward. And I also think it will continue to accelerate. I think its share price will continue to strengthen. And I think as an economic viable organisation, it will get stronger and stronger over the next 3 years. I think with the technology that it has got, it's difficult to know what the rabbit out of the hat is going to be. And that's going to require some clever thinking from the creative team at Apple. But Apple are very good at being creative. They've got some great creative people. My worry is this, and that is the strategy over Lion. I'm worried about Lion because Lion and its potential next iterations is effectively trying to move the desktop OS of the PC to the iPad iOS paradigm, you know, by introducing the apps and all of the other things. And I actually think that that's a mistake. And the reason why I say that is because whilst Apple products still sell incredibly well in the market space, they still only hold a relatively small segment of the PC sector. The PC sector is enormous for PC sales. The sales of Apple PC products into the marketplace haven't even got going yet. With people buying iPhones and iPads and seeing what that technology can do, the next purchase in your mind will be an Apple machine. Having an Apple machine at home, that's what you aspire to. It's the, you know, £300, £200 on a contract iPhone, then £600, £800 on an iPad. Your next aspirational purchase is £2,000 on an iMac or a MacBook or something like that, and you will pay that. Now, the thing is that the differentiator needs to be, the Mac needs to be a desktop environment, and OS X is perfect for that, and the leap from iPad to OS X is just perfect at the moment, and I don't think it needs to be changed. I think there's a little bit of running ahead and failing to see the amount of market share that Apple can take just by doing nothing with the Mac other than just keeping it up to spec with performance. So that's Rick's prediction. See what happens.
See, I like you devil's advocate is my first point. I'm going to play devil's advocate to yours, and I think where they're going with Lion is actually very strong. Some of the decisions I think have been a bit dodgy, but the major ones that you focus on, the App Store, I think is a great innovation, because it's going to turn software development away from the people that can host apps to everyone. And I know that 3 years ago I wrote an image resizer for Apple, you know, for Mac, and I thought I could sell this for a couple of quid, but I can't afford to go through all the faff of doing that because of the work involved just wasn't going to be worth it. And I revisited the idea a couple of months ago. I thought, I'll put it on the App Store, and now it's making me money. And I think that is a powerful tool to get a lot of developers on your site. And with developers, become gives you a bigger list of apps that people will then want to buy Macs for. And we're seeing a lot of high-profile games starting to appear on Mac now as well, both because of the App Store and because Steam is now on Mac. So through the App Store, I keep seeing big games popping up on the list, like Call of Duty and things. And these will make Macs more appealing to people like me, who like to play games.
Whereas previously, it was like, oh yeah, I'd like it, but I can't play any games on it, was the thing, wasn't it?
And then on the other side, I think that bridge between the iPad and the desktop, so far it's good. I see what you mean. I worry that if they go too far, then you're going to lose some of the features that make the desktop as useful as it is. But at the moment, they haven't gotten anywhere near as crazy as this kind of Windows 8 Metro type prospect. Which is basically saying, you know, we're going to put a tablet interface on your desktop. Have fun.
Yeah, desktop pandering to fashions of other ways.
Well, this is the difference between imprinting your vision on an organisation and leaving it rudderless. That's what I'm talking about.
What's clever with Lion is that they've only brought a couple of features across and they're actually useful. To start with, you go, really? What's that for? But, for instance, if I put my mouse in the corner of the screen, then it brings up my app list as a set of icons, like on the iPad. And actually, I found out when you've got your touchpad on your MacBook, that's really useful. Because now I can just swoop through my apps with my fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And full screen apps, I was very dubious about at first. Because 27-inch iMac, why do I want to dedicate that screen to one thing? But I recently got a 13-inch MacBook Pro, and screen space is a bit of a premium there, and even more so, I guess, on the MacBook Air, which is their kind of netbook competitor. And full-screen apps really make a difference there. It's very much like the iPad. You get your three apps up that you want, and you just use your two fingers or three fingers on the laptop to sweep between the apps that are open.
Mm-hmm.
And that experience, which is very similar to the iPad, where you can sweep between apps with four fingers now. And it's great to just be able to do it on both. They went a bit crazy with the one thing I think they've gone a bit crazy with, and it still throws me, is to keep up with the iPad touchpad experience, they've reversed the scroll wheel on Lion.
Uh-huh.
You can turn it off, but so now you sweep your two fingers up and the page moves. Well, it's really weird, because to start with it messes you up, but about a week after using it, because I've been using an iPad so much, now it's weird when I do it the other way. Because the logic is, before, you moved your fingers down the touch mouse, the magic mouse, and then it would scroll down, which sounds logical. But actually what they want you to feel like you're doing is you're pushing the page up.
I could get used to that.
Like on the iPad, you put your two fingers on the screen and then push up. And you're actually scrolling down because you're pushing the content up through the viewport that you're looking through.
That's weird, because up until you mentioned that then, I have naturally just done that and never thought anything about it on the iPad, but you're absolutely right. And from the very first time that I wanted to look at a screen, I've done that.
Mm.
So I never even thought about it. So I can understand why it probably does feel right and does make sense.
But to do it on a mouse seemed weird at first, but now, you know, so now I can push up and the document moves up, which means you're scrolling down.
Okay.
It's weird, but it gels the whole iPad OS X experience.
So in summary, let's throw this ball to Jack. And the big question is obviously, Jack, the last time we played poker, you took the best part of 15 grand off John and I. Are you feeling comfortable about burying that in the markets, backing it all on Apple shares? What do you think, mate?
No, yeah, I mean, there'll be this slight wobble that John's talking about. I don't think in the long term it'll be anything more than a wobble. I mean, as far as like how Jobs passing on has affected things, if anything, it's just more publicity, and people are always going to want the product. I mean, he's been a tremendous figurehead, but in terms of like Apple, I mean, I think they've got a plan. They're bound to have a plan for like the next 10, 20, 50 years. As to where they're going to go, and he's going to make sure all this is in place already. So I don't think he's left them rudderless, as you say. I don't think we'll see any major innovations in the near future, but I don't think that will hurt them because people are scared by major innovations. I think they did very well with the iPad, but everybody was like, "Oh, terrible idea." I mean, until it worked, and then suddenly it was like the next big thing, and everybody was doing it. But that was like their last major innovation. It was his last. The last big thing he came up with, and I don't know if you'll see anything like that in the near future. I think it'll just be refinements of what we're seeing already. Not that that'll hurt him in the slightest.
Mm.
Just I don't know if you'll see anything dramatically different technology-wise. No dramatic improvements.
I find it really interesting because Apple very rarely bring new technology to the table. They just do it right.
Mm.
Tablet PCs have been around for God knows how long. But they just kind of go, if I were to use this, what would be the best case scenario? And they try and make that, as opposed to other companies who just seem to go, it's something new, we'll just build it and they will come.
It's not even just something that they try and make something better than other people. They say, oh, this is the way we would do it. It's kind of like something else again, isn't it? It's just like, oh, yeah, you do it your way, but we're going to do it our way. Do you want it our way? It's very... You can see why people like throw charges of elitism at him, but for the most part, I mean, it is better. I mean, it does feel superior, but it's very much its own thing. You know, I mean, some things they do, you can tell they're doing it just to make it different, just to make it their own. And I mean, that sounds worse than it is, to be honest, because what you're essentially doing is you're just branding the product, and there's nothing really wrong with that.
There's a great thing that I read somewhere, and I try and remind myself of it now and then because I think it's a great sort of paradigm that I heard. That Apple follow, and the thing they said is that they look at every element and consider whether it is the best.
Mm.
And the example I always give as to why this was so great is the MacBook power supply. So where every other laptop developer just says, "Oh, well, you have a power supply and it plugs in," Apple look at every step and go, "Can we make this bit better?" And they looked at the power supply, something that no one else would bother looking at, and went, "Can we make it better?" And they said, well, yes, if we make it magnetic, then that stupid little pin doesn't break off on your laptop, which I've seen break so many times. So they did, and it's better.
Mm.
You know, and they do that to all the elements. They kind of go, well, this keyboard, can we make it better? As opposed to just sort of saying, well, we've got a great laptop. We need to put a keyboard in there. Whack this one in. They just look at it all and go, how can we make that bit of this technology better?
Yeah.
And I think that's...
That's the genius. That's the genius, and that's what did it. And that's what took them to where they are, a few of the technical things aside. But yeah, absolutely. I think Tim Cook has got big shoes to fill. He's got a big position to fill, and he needs to take a pinch of the Jobs imprint and step forward. Be confident and step forward. He's leading an awesome team and leading an awesome company. Rest assured that should give him a huge amount of confidence. My final word from me on this is... That Steve Jobs should go with the grace of God. Peace.
Clickety click.
Oh no, you can't be endorsing certain insurance companies on a. Isn't that their slogan? Clickety click, job done. I can't say who they are because I hate them and I don't want to. I don't want to give him a leg up.
No idea what you're talking about, to be honest.
You've got to watch TV, John. You watch TV, you'll be up to date on all the latest insurance-related jokes.
I'm aware that there is an invention called television, but that's about it.
Yeah, that's what you need to know, really.
Cool, so it's time for app reviews, then.
Okay.
App reviews.
What have you got to show us this time, Jack?
All right. Surprisingly enough, brace yourself. It's a game. Because I like games. I'm going to make sure you guys like games as well. Today, we're doing... It's another... actually ties into one I did previously. And that was a flashback from Delphine Software, was the developers. And but before that, everybody who played Flashback remembers the one before it, Another World, which was which brought the very distinctive visual style of the rotoscoped animation. And that was all present here. And basically, the setup was that you were a scientist who was mucking about with a particle accelerator late one night, and something went wrong, of course, and he ended up getting sent to another world. So, right, just fire it up, and here we see. Just get past the menu a second. And here we can see, yeah, I mean, they kept this is all the artwork from the original game. This is, like, full-on nostalgia happy. They've got all the old music and stuff like that. Very distinctive visual style. It really did feel like you were in some alien landscape. If I just...
Presumably it's all been HD'd up, if it's going to run on the iPad and the iPhone 4.
Looking at this, it all looks pretty sharp.
That background music that's running there is quite awesome.
It is, and this has all been beefed up. I don't remember it being this great back in the day, even with my rose-tinted glasses.
I guess back then, not only was it MIDI files, but you also... The graphics are probably like 320 by 240, so not even the resolution of an iPhone 3GS.
Mm. Yes, yes, exactly. Now you can see, I always love this bit. And the car swings in. I'm not sure if you can skip the intro, I'll try in a second, but they've redone it. It all runs so much more smoothly than I remember, and he goes in and he shuts the door, and it had this big old opening cinematic where he went into his lab, and everything you were looking at, you were just thinking, wow, is the elevator going down, and this... You'd never seen visuals like this before at the time.
But this is like a cartoon. It's just like watching a cartoon. Exactly.
At the time, I remember I was completely bowled over and the game hadn't even started yet. But if you imagine all this on like an Atari ST, I think it played on. I won't show you the whole thing. I'll just get you to the meat of the...
Of course, back then it ran in 32 colours because they had to make it...
I mean, it was a dramatic step, wasn't it, when you went from like things like basically sort of 8-bit micros up to the 16-bit Atari STs, etc. That transition in graphical quality and everything else. I mean, I can remember the Amiga and the ST coming out and looking at the games and going, wow, look at that, that's incredible.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, here we see, like, as soon as you, like, you're transported to this completely foreign landscape with all this rocky... with these blue skies and strange environment. There's tentacles coming up out of the water. If you actually remain in place too long, they pull you back down into the water. There's like a million ways to die in this game. Okay. And there's like strange creatures in the background that we can see moving about. See, there's another one there. So, if I go this way, if I try and work out the controls... All right, see that? That makes me kick.
So it plays like Flashback with the...
I think so, yeah. I mean, this is my first time actually handling the controls. And I've just been poisoned by a leech and get that animation there, and then the guy drops over dead. There's no health, there's no lives, you're dead. Because yeah, you're screwed up.
That's going to be a punishing game.
It is a little bit. A lot of it was not so much action and reflexes. It was kind of like that each area was sort of like a puzzle, but a puzzle based on like on where to move and when. So it's kind of reflexes, but it's also like knowing when to go to certain places, when to react, when to jump over things.
You know what it makes me think of? If someone found an adventure game book and turned it into a 2D platformer, that's kind of the hybrid between the two. Because you go the wrong way and you die, so you go back a few pages and try again.
Yeah, exactly. You see, there's more leeches everywhere. I'm just... As far as I can see, it's quite a streamlined... control system. Like if you move right to the edge, then that seems to do I've been poisoned again. But yeah, if I could get far enough, which I obviously won't during the course of this review, then you can see that that black lion beastie we saw in the background, and I remember this from the original. Then you run into him and he drops down ready to savage you, so you have to run all the way back again and find a way to swing past him and like get onto the next bit of the game. But you had to work that out through a series of trial and error to make sure you didn't get killed by, like, fools or rocks or killer leeches or not staying ahead of the giant lion beastie. Mm-hmm. And this was just the first of, like, many, many areas. And the most interesting thing about the game is there was no on-screen icons or text or anything like that. it was all done through visuals and sounds. I mean, I don't think there's even a spoken word in the game except for a little bit of alien language. It all added up to a lot of a very immersive experience. But if you haven't played it, even if you have played it, absolutely fantastic. So that's available for the iPhone and the iPad. It's one version for the pair of them, and that's £2.99.
Oh, cool.
Might have to check that out.
Pretty cool. What have you got for us, Rick?
Okay, well, I'm going to do something slightly different today because it's not really an app. It's more a suite of apps and software and all kinds of stuff. I've been reviewing PC Linux OS over the last couple of weeks. And basically, it's a full Linux operating system, so you can download it, and the review and show notes give you the download links and everything else to get the ISO and so on and so forth. But basically, it's a full operating system. You can run it as a live CD if you want. Mm-hmm. So put it in and boot into the OS and try it. You can install it dual boot, and the installer will take care of resizing and sorting your Windows partition, making some space on the disk, installing itself, and then giving you a choice at bootload time. Mm-hmm. So if you're wanting to install it live, it will sort all of that out for you in a very easy, user-friendly fashion. And ultimately, it's just, a Linux operating system. So I'm saying that fairly broad for anybody who's not come across Linux before. Maybe you've just used Windows and Apple. What I like about this operating system is that I think for new users to the Linux OS, it offers loads of familiar functionality in a really easy-to-use way. The popular Linux OSs like OpenSUSE, Fedora and Ubuntu, for example, the issues that they have is that because they're popular, certain things like installing Flash out of the box doesn't happen. Installing the MP3 codecs out of the box doesn't happen. So although you install the operating system, you go to a website and then actually Flash doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And although the messages have got great and it says, you know, hey, look, you haven't got Flash installed. Would you like to install Flash? Yes. And then it goes and does it for you and installs it. Again, from a user perspective, it's kind of a hurdle. I don't get that with Windows. I go to Windows and it just works. Mm-hmm. Or I pick up my MP3s off my disk or off my little, you know, USB stick, and I go to play them and, oh, GStreamer hasn't got the right codecs. Do you want to get the right codecs? These are hurdles for people. PC Linux OS has dealt with that. And I think that's credit to the development team that have developed the distro, because they're being brave. You know, yes, there are issues with patent encumberment, and there's a risk that you might be prosecuted under patent laws and these kinds of things. But they've kind of said,
little stuff.
Yeah, little stuff that could see you effectively, you know, bankrupt and out of business pretty quickly if somebody wanted to attack you. But they've been really bold with their distribution, and they've wrapped all of these things straight into the distro out of the box. So that's what it is. And that's how you can get it and install it. Let's talk about the experience that I had installing it. Well, I installed it and set it up, found that an absolute doddle. It was about four questions that it asks you. It takes care of all the disk installation, guides you through all of that, asks you about three or four questions, and just installs, pops you straight to a boot prompt, asks you for password, and you're ready to log in. That was really easy to do, and it took about 15 minutes. So really fast and simple and accessible, and I think that that's important. I'm presented with a desktop which looks really nice. You could see that, you know, you've got a nice silvery sheen background with a PC Linux OS background, start type button in the left-hand side. What's good about that is that migrating people from Windows who are interested in wanting to have a play around with Linux and see what that operating system has to offer, it's going to be really familiar. Everything's where you expect it to be. Mm-hmm. Start bar, click that up, menu bars, all your programs there are organized. So for a general desktop use, really good. It's got a bunch of programs installed already, quite a lot of them. So Office programs, some graphics programs, a camera program, and they've chosen what I would say are the pedigree class open source apps. So Digicam, with a K, is the open source photography app. It's a bit like Picasa or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's an absolute doddle to use. You plug your camera into the thing, plug your camera in, and 90% of the time, the system will immediately detect your camera. No need to install any disks or drivers. it will automatically open Digicam, suck all of your images in and splat them all up there, and you can label them and organise them. You can even shove them up straight out of the app to Spotify or Flickr, or not Spotify, sorry, to Flickr or Picasa, yeah. And just immediately export them out to those things, all built in. So a really nice user-friendly app. It's also got Clementine, which is a music player based on Forkoff Amarok, very much like iTunes.
Okay.
And that's plugged straight into your devices. Plug your phone in, up comes Clementine, sees all your devices, allows you to play stuff straight off your device, pick up the iPhone and so on and so forth. Even with its proprietary stuff, it'll just work.
Oh, that's good, yeah.
PC Linux OS is about, it just works out of the box. That's what I really like about it. The same experience with configuring a printer. Literally, three clicks. Click, it searches the network. I found a HP printer, want to install it? Yes, please. Do you want to test it? Yes, please. Out comes a test page, printer, done, online. Cinch, absolute cinch.
Because you said it, I'll believe you, but if anybody else had told me that, I don't know, printers.
The real piece de resistance, though, the bit that I really liked about it, desktop really good, general overall production really good. Very often, we might want to set up things for serving things. So maybe we want to set up a Windows share file server, or maybe we want to set up a web server to run some stuff on, or whatever it might be. It's got in the control panel, which sits on the dock, basically like a computer and a screwdriver, so it's obvious that this is computer settings. Click that button. On the left hand side is a list of configurations: DNS server, DHCP server, Samba, Windows share, Apache file server, FTP server, whatever you want. Click, say you want to set up an FTP server. You click the FTP server and it asks you about three questions. So it says, do you want to set up an FTP server? Do you want to enable SFTP? Do you want to have anonymous logins? Mm-hmm. Tick the three boxes, click OK. It installs everything, sucks all the software down over your internet connection, configures everything, sets it up, fires up all the services and shuts the window. Just slick. Yeah. Really, really easy to use. And I was really, really, really impressed with what they've done. I'm surprised, actually, that it doesn't get as much traction on DistroWatch or as many downloads. And that's probably because, there isn't so many people making such a noise about it. So that's my summary of it. PC Linux OS. You can download the ISO as a CD image, or load it into VirtualBox, or run it as a live CD. Download it. It's free. So you're not going to cost you anything. Comes with a whole bunch of software. You spend a good couple of hours having some fun with that and playing around with it and geeking out. Awesome. Awesome, yeah. Distro.
Yeah, that's what everybody wants. It's like operating system that just works and it's free.
Yep. Might put your claims to the test and see if everything works when I plug it in through USB.
Yeah. See if you can install a printer.
Report back in a couple of weeks' time and see what happens.
Yeah, see what your experience is. That'd be really good.
I've returned to the iPad for my app goodness, and I'd like to show you something called 123D Sculpt by Autodesk. Autodesk being the people that have made a lot of the heavy hitter 3ds Max 3D modeling programs, as well as Autodesk Sketchbook Pro and things like that. So they're quite
They're a big deal.
So I'll try and emulate what happens when you use it for the first time. So if we make a brand new 3D figure here, you can start with the predefined shapes. So they've got a person, a dog, a perched owl. They've also got basic geometry if you want to be a little bit more hardcore. And they've got some really strange objects.
Got a moose head.
A moose head, if you wish to start off there. But
sneakers and shoes. That's
a t-shirt. That's probably quite a good example, because you can play around with that a little bit. So we'll start off with a t-shirt shape. And so here it is in 3D. You can move around it with one finger, but when you touch it, you're actually then in sculpt mode. So you can see here, I'm going to add some wrinkles to the surface of that t-shirt.
That looks like one of my t-shirts.
Yeah.
And if we turn around to the side here, you can see the wrinkles that I've added.
Can you do an iron? Because if you do an iron, he can get the wrinkles out of his T-shirt.
Yeah, so you can practice. It's an ironing sim in disguise.
So we've got this here where you can brush on the sculpture to pull bits out. You can layer up, so you can...
You just thicken kind up of that
similar,
shirt.
But you add layers on top instead. Then you can do the opposite. Obviously, you can push bits in. So maybe he's got a very thin waist or something. There we go. His belly sticking out. If you've made a bit of a mess of it, you can smooth out.
Oh, you can smooth it out. Oh, that's awesome.
So there's your iron, Jack. That's how. If only you could iron your shirts with your finger.
Yeah.
I think you can make creases with this guy. Yeah, there you go. So where you've got,
oh yeah,
where you've got something which is a bit big because you've got a massive, you know, big finger which you're dragging around the screen, you can go, well, actually, I want that edge to be sharp. So you rub your finger across it a bit, and now you can see it.
Can you work over larger areas? Okay. Like if you wanted to, say, like, apply a great big layer?
Yeah, well, you can change the size and strength of the brush as you're working. So do, like, bigger indents, you could do more intense but smaller indents, for instance.
All right, so you've got complete control over your brush size, so to speak.
Is that the wrong one? There you go. That's added quite thick layers there because it's got a strong but reasonably small brush. Now he's looking a bit like something out of Gears of War, you know.
Yeah.
A little bit alien. But then, yeah, so then we can flatten that out, and then, but you know, that's the kind of fun bit. You can do things symmetrically as well. So if you're trying to model something like a face, then something which will be on
clever,
this side,
yeah,
automatically goes across on that side. And then a lot of the fun comes in adding the textures.
Oh, you can texture them as well.
So now I've got my perfect unironed T-shirt. I'm going to colour it in.
So you can do T-shirt designs.
Yeah, that's
of course. We're just talking about T-shirts here, but you could model anything, I suppose, with this, couldn't you?
Precisely. I mean, I think it would be quite a lot of work to make, say, a game character.
Yeah. But technically, could you do it? I mean, can you export files and everything?
That's the flaw at the moment. There are a lot of comments building up on the App Store. Once you've built your file, it's on your iPad. You can export images of it, but you can't export the file.
Okay,
But I would be very surprised if Autodesk didn't let you export it as either a 3DS file or an object file, which is Autodesk's file formats for 3D models, because it doesn't really make sense that you can't. This is the other cool thing you can do. So not only can you use the solid colours textures like we were doing just then, you can bring this image texture on top here and then paint it through to what's underneath as well.
So you kind of like rub it on like a transfer?
Precisely, yeah, that's a good...
Okay.
And you can even use your own images as textures.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So images that you've made in Sketchbook Pro, another iPad app, you can import into this to layer on top of your model. So let's put this kind of weird cog thing on the back of the shirt.
That's quite powerful. Would you say you have as much... would you say this could be a substitute for doing it on a computer?
I don't think
it less,
so.
Is it less control? Yeah,
I think it's more of a toy.
I thought possibly it might be more. You might have more control because you're like moulding it with your fingers, so to speak. But is that just like a bit wishful thinking?
I mean, I haven't done a massive amount of 3D modelling other than kind of polygon modelling.
Mm-hmm.
So I see something like this, not really applicable to my uses for that reason. For that purpose. Because you obviously can't pick the vertices and move them around because meant to be a sculpting program. So for me, I see it as kind of quite a cool toy to play with. And, you know, that's... You could mock up a T-shirt design and someone could go, but what would it look like on a T-shirt?
I
could go, well, here's the image, here's a T-shirt, bum, bum, bum. There's an example.
What would it look like if a moose was wearing it? There you go.
So when you've got 5 minutes, can you stick the at random cartoon on it? And we can see what at random T-shirt looked like.
We'll do that and we'll export it and put it on the website.
Yeah. Awesome.
And then if they're cool, we'll let you pre-order them maybe. If we get enough orders, we'll make them.
Mm.
could see a nice blue at random t-shirt with our little faces on, yeah.
Does it have any kind of like particles or like textures like hair and things like that, you know what I mean? Sort of like if you were making a face up, can you add like hair and, you know, that sort of stuff?
No.
We'll need that for my beard.
not in this one. I mean, like I say, it is just a free app.
Yeah, okay.
They make it's free. It's completely free.
Blimey.
They make a little bit of money because you can buy extra base objects. But I suspect if it's popular, then either they will add to it, or another company will see the idea and turn it into a more fully fledged modelling suite.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's more of a Autodesk going, oh, here's a proof of concept. What do you think of it?
Yeah.
I get that feel, you know, it's really good at what it does, but it doesn't do everything that you can do in something like Blender or 3ds Max.
Yeah.
But neither is it supposed to, I don't think. You know, it's just meant to kind of go, well, look, people usually sculpt with their hands.
Try it.
Using a mouse is a bit weird for that. Try it with your hands.
Mm.
You go, that's quite cool. I can push this shape around, and you can start with a sphere and with a lot of work turn it into a face, you know.
I mean, what you've got to just in this couple of minutes that you've talked here, though. I mean, I've spent quite a few hours messing around with Blender, trying to get used to the user interface of it and trying to get to use it a little bit. I don't have any creative aspirations to me at all, but I know that if I was to try to create that in Blender, even if I started with a base T-shirt object like you have, just those kind of outcroppings and little bits that you built onto the shoulders and stuff to kind of pad the shoulders out, that would take a long time to create that object in Blender, you know, to extrude the shapes and model it and so on and so forth. And so it's very accessible in terms of, you know, what it's generating and what you can do.
And it's just a lot of, it's just fun to play with. I think that's why they released it, you know, just so people can kind of take a shoe and paint it how they would picture it.
Yeah.
You know, because you can colour in the shoe and things, and it's just fun to, a little toy to play with, keep you entertained for half an hour to an hour.
Mm.
Quite cool to show off to your mates.
Mm. For free, you can't say fairer than that, can you?
So that's Autodesk 123D Sculpt for the iPad, and it's free. So.
It's free.
Awesome. At random. Hiya lads, yeah, Jerry, Manc Techie coming back at ya. Yeah, hey lads, that invitation, come on and do a show special, that's mega. So right, yeah, I'd love it, yeah. So I'll do Magna Tune for you, no worries, that's absolutely great. This week's special is another Magna Tune track. The band's called Spine Car, this one's called Home. Check it out, it's rocking. Yay. Cool. Rock it. You knows it.
So. Cleared me out a little bit. That's good. Oh. Do like it. A little bit like System. It's good. Anyway, thanks for that, Jerry. Nice little stuff.
He knows his stuff,
Jerry. So it's time for our plus ones, and we've decided to broaden our horizons a little bit this time.
We're going
to
broaden your horizons, dear viewer.
Dear viewer?
Listener?
Viewer?
I hope it's not a viewer. I've got a face for radio.
This is my previous career in television, I think. So the force of
his dreams here of television. But yes, so we're going to broaden the plus one spectrum a little bit by not only plus one-ing websites, but plus one-ing other media too, such as books and I guess music, maybe even one day.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Could be quite cool. So let's kick off with our first book plus one, eh, Rick?
Okay, cool. Look, I've got the said book here for you guys to have a look at. Got a little bit of an image of the front cover, give you an idea of what it's about. Okay. The title of the book is Linux Assembly Language Programming, and the author I can't pronounce. Well, I can pronounce his first name, which is Bob, and then the second name is Nevelen, or N-E-V-E-L-N. Anyway, it's all in the show notes, and the bits and details up there. So, basically, it's all x86, so Intel x86 assembly language, also applicable, of course, to AMD processors as well. But the book is a fairly concise book, 272 pages, starts at the very beginning and takes you through the foundation concepts and eases you into what is potentially, I would think, for a lot of people, a pretty scary subject. Often these days, assembly language programming is kind of quite revered because of all the levels of abstraction that we've got. I would argue that it's a lot less complicated than you would think, but writing things in assembly is very long-winded. But if you're interested in getting right down to the hardware layer, if you're interested in maybe writing kind of device drivers or that kind of stuff, and you want to be able to really get to the nitty-gritty, or you just want to see how fast you know, something can multiply out to a Googleplex, then assembly is the place to start. So the book takes you through 272 pages. It starts right at the basics. So it looks at two's complement, binary, octal, hexadecimal. It also looks at logic gates and takes you through those paradigms and considers lists, stacks, etc. So it gives you the base foundations that you'll need, and then it takes you on right through into writing assembly code, looking at all of the different aspects of that. It takes you through the tools as well, so it explains how to use GCC and how to use NASM, etc. to do all the assembly stuff. I've been reading the book last week. I had I've got about halfway through it, and then I sort of briefly flipped through to the end just to make sure that I was fairly confident about giving it a good rating. I'm really impressed with the book. I've read quite a lot of books back in the day on 6809 and 6800 and 8600 and Z80 assembler and various different things. And some of them can be quite inaccessible. I found this really accessible. It's great that it gives you the introductory knowledge to get you involved into what is potentially a really interesting topic. So I've got that from Safari Books Online, and I was really impressed with it. Yeah,
worth reading, even if you're not going to actually do any assembly programming? Because let's be honest, I dabbled with it in the past, but I've never really had the need to use its performance increase over the development time it would add to my project.
Yeah. I think I would say yes. I mean, one of the things that I think we very often suffer with is that the multiple layers of abstraction, particularly at the developer level or the user level with computers now, we are so removed from the hardware that it's very difficult to understand or to even visualize what the hardware is doing and how the operating system and your computer programs and applications are interacting with the hardware. The great thing about this book is that certainly in the first four chapters, it will get you over that hurdle. It'll give you the idea of what the memory management unit is doing, what the ALU unit is doing, what the registers are and the stacks are. And that base foundation knowledge is really useful when you start trying to think about what your C program or your C# program is doing at that layer. So really good, strong foundation knowledge that I would say anybody who's serious about computer science. You really do need to know this stuff. It's the foundations of everything. And it does talk about the von Neumann structures, how that strategy works, and it also it introduces the concept with a little introduction to ENIAC and explains how ENIAC was coded and how it worked. So definitely worth a read, even if you're... You don't necessarily need to read the whole book, because the back end is the book is very much about using the tools, reference, and so on and so forth. But the early part of the book, if you want a really good, solid foundation of computer science, excellent book to read.
So for somebody like me, as like a complete entry level, I mean, is this would this be a good place to start, or is this a bit would this be a bit above my head?
No, I think you would find this accessible. Okay. There are I think there are some you might wrestle a little bit with the number systems if you have never experienced number bases and you don't have any concept about that.
Sure.
That can be challenging to think about counting in base 2 or octal or hexadecimal, but it does do a great job of explaining that, and it explains how the counting systems work by using real world examples of monetary divisions. So it explains how money works and then explains how you can interpret that so that it gets over the problem of understanding the maths that you need. It deals with that really well. It then spends time explaining the logic gate structures, so NOTs, ORs, exclusive ORs, ANDs, NANDs, latches, explains how all of those things are constructed, so you understand how logic and registers are constructed, how you make adders, etc. And it explains that really clearly, so the combination of mathematics and logic gates gives you that foundation. I think that even if you didn't know anything about computers, provided you've got a reasonable, good grasp of arithmetic, basic general arithmetic, you could get into the topic with this book. It would make sense.
Okay, that's good then, yeah. It opens it up to a wider field, doesn't it? Because I know people would listen to some of what you'd said and say, oh, no, it's scary.
Yeah.
But no, it's good to hear you say that. Like, anybody who's like intelligent and interested is going to be able to get into this.
Yeah, I think so, most definitely.
Cool. And what was that called again?
That book is called Linux Assembly Language Programming. It's by Bob Nevelin. The publisher is Prentice Hall, and 272 pages, and available via Safari Books Online if you want to. You could probably get it in the iBooks store as well, maybe, because it's already available electronically. I would think you might be able to get it there. Or, of course, hard copy from Amazon.
Probably on Kindle.
Yeah, more than likely is.
That's cool. I'm also going to bring a book to the table this show, and this is, I was about to say, very specific, but probably no more specific than Linux Assembler. So I've got a passing interest in game development, one could say, and have been doing quite a lot of work with Cocos 2D on the iPhone. And Cocos is a game development. Oh, it's not quite an engine, so it's more of a framework, I guess, which will help you build a game. So you download the Cocos libraries, and then they give you all the base objects that you need to sort of put a game together. So you can just extend these objects, and hey presto, with a little bit of work, you've got a basic game. And it's very well structured. It's 2D, obviously, Cocos 2D. Although they are adding some 3D extensions to it now, which is a bit weird.
And it just ruined their brand entirely.
I think it's one of the kind of spin-offs that someone's done, and it's they're letting you put 3D text over the top of your 2D game and things.
Sure.
But it's an open source project. And
love it.
Kind of developed by at Rick as he says it.
I love it already. Source. That's me. It's good.
Developed by the community, and I've even put a bit of code back into the project.
So now that rocks. We're at 9 out of 10 now, Jack. That's amazing. when it's open source and we're committing code back to the community, that is awesome.
It's going
to
feature in 1.01, by the way, my code.
They didn't just spit it out and go, "That's rubbish." We're not patching that in.
Maybe they're just being polite and they're going to do that, but it's a really good framework, but obviously if you're learning iPhone programming and the idea of programming for mobile device and this at the same time, it can be a lot of work. So this book is Learning Cocos 2D a hands-on guide to building iOS games with Cocos 2D, Box 2D, and Chipmunk. Long title. And that's by Rod Strauger and Ray Wenderlich. Now, Ray's got a website, and he's been doing Cocos 2D tutorials for quite some time. So I guess this book is kind of a spin-off from that. But this book takes you through the process. It's kind of one massive tutorial. By massive, I mean it's hard to tell because it's on Kindle, and Kindle breaks the book into locations as opposed to pages. But I think it's about 700 pages. So we're talking a big, healthy-sized purchase. But it takes you through the process of making a game from scratch. So they start off and they teach you what Cocos 2D is, tell you a little bit about the game that the book's going to take you through making. It's obviously only a very simple game, because it's going to walk you through hand in hand.
When you say from scratch, John, sorry to butt in there, but when you say from scratch, could you give me an example of where scratch is? Is it like the basics, or is it, you know, you're expected to have a level of knowledge at X?
You're expected to have programming knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
It would help if you'd played with the iPhone programming a bit before. I guess, you know, it doesn't teach you Objective-C.
Okay.
But it doesn't assume that you know that much about it, because when you use Cocos, you don't really need to know much about the iPhone libraries as they stand, because you're nearly always interacting with the Cocos libraries. So there's a great, I think it's Coco with Love, or Theo Coco, or maybe they're the same. But that's two websites I remember from when I learned Coco a couple of years ago, and they're great introductions to Coco. And I guess if you've an Objective-C, I guess if you've gone through those and understood the memory management behind Objective-C, then you'll be ready to go.
Okay, yeah.
From Coco with Love. That's lovely.
So it starts off by taking a look at Cocos 2D and telling you about how it works. There's a basic object in it, which is a CC node, and that essentially forms the heart of the whole of the kind of framework. Everything somewhere will be derived from CC node, and CC nodes will update every frame and draw every frame if necessary. And this all fits into a big kind of structure. Cocos started off as a Python library, but I guess it never really hit the same level of fame as it did since it's been on the iPhone.
Do you know if it's still available as a Python library then? So you could
fairly certainly,
you know, you could tinker around with it, for example. If you've got Python installed on your Windows desktop or your Linux desktop, you could do some of the stuff that's in this using the library.
I guess the libraries have probably diverged a bit now, because I know that a lot of things in the iPhone library have kind of evolved over time. So unless Python's kind of been following it, it's probably diverged a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the core mechanics will be the same across all platforms, and they're rolling it out to other platforms now. So there's Cocos JavaScript, Cocos C#, Cocos C, and, you know, like, obviously
some kind of web app based games developed in Cocos then.
Yeah, I had a quick play with it right back when it was in alpha, and it was quite promising even then. So it goes through from a game development terms from the beginning. So it says this is the concept of a scene, objects in a scene. We'll do a bit of collision detection, add some enemies, put some labels on, make a HUD, add the concept of having different scenes, so it's not just a game, but it has a main menu. Then it goes into sound, which luckily Cocos worries about, so you don't have to. You just tell it to play music, play sound effects, essentially. Then it adds the concept of scrolling, and then it tells you how to integrate your game with the two popular physics engines for the iPhone, which is Box 2D and Chipmunk. Sorry, 2D physics engines. And then it goes into some more advanced parts of game development, like using that physics and integrating it with your game, some leaderboards, performance optimizations, and constructing levels as opposed to just having it all in code, so having your levels read in from data files. But it's a really good read, and I'm kind of using it more partly as a reference book, I guess, and to see if how I've been doing things is matches up with someone else. And it's heartening to see where it does and where it doesn't. It's nice to read the difference is in what I've done compared to them, to see if it's because their way is better or just because I've got a different use case. Mm-hmm. But it is really interesting, and while reading it, it does feel like a massive tutorial, and I think I'd be comfortable if I had this resource available when I started playing with Kokos about a year ago. Would have been really useful. Mm. It's a very friendly introduction.
So are there... So you mentioned the word tutorial there. For example, if I was coming to this and I had my Xcode environment up, could I utilise that book, pull some of the code segments out of it, run them, compile them, build some little examples? So, you know, I get the concepts, but I also get to play around with the code and experiment with the syntax and things like that. Is that possible from the book as well?
Yeah, so you can build the code as you go along and see the game kind of being built in a logical step.
Awesome.
Okay, so, yeah, as you really finish good. A couple of chapters, then you build that code and get, oh, there's the level scrolling around. And then the next one, you add a bad guy, and then you see it happening, and you can download the code, or you can
I was just going to say that.
It in
can
yourself.
You download the code rather than, like, you know, keying it in by hand?
Like the old school stuff.
Yeah. And then 10 million syntax errors later, you get it to compile.
And this is the end result, basically. So,
is the game?
They've put it on the App Store for free, so you can download it. Obviously, it kind of could do with an artistic touch, I guess, but that's...
I think it's perfect.
The product of a programmer's work. So you can pick your level.
This is showing off. The book leads to the game, and here's the game. I think you're doing two app reviews here. He's hogging the show.
But, you know, it's kind of a bit like Another World, which is kind of...
Well, it's with Vikings.
And you can jump, and you can hit things.
And how? Look at that. It's like a kangaroo.
But, you know, like the levels kind of go through with the different chapters, so you can see the parallax scrolling here. But, you know, it's...
You can see there straight away that with those concepts... Obviously, you get to the end of that book, you can write this code, if you now understand this code, the game that you were showing a moment ago, Jack, you could then go off and write that mm-hmm. with that kind of knowledge.
Yeah. Yep. But yeah, so that's that is Learning Kokos 2D by Rod Schroeger and Ray Wenderlich. What have you got, Jackson?
All I have got, it's not a book. It's not a book. It is, in fact, a website.
I guess that's what we set them out to be to start with. And John and I have gone off on some kind of odd tangent.
Oh no! This is a good thing. It's kind of like a subject. It's kind of close to my heart, but I'll go into that in a second. This is something that people may or may not have heard of. It's Encyclopedia Dramatica, John's obviously heard of it. And basically what it is a complete parody of Wikipedia, but put together by all kinds of, like, forum communities. I think some of them are hackers, a lot of them are just, like, forum posters and things like that. But there's, like, a loose sense of community, like, continuously, like, ripping these articles to pieces. And there's articles on just about everything you can think of, like with Wikipedia, except it's more it's a bit more internet-centred, and nearly all of it is it's all humorous but incredibly offensive. And I think that's what sets it apart for me, is that on these articles it seems that people don't care what they write. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's funny, but it's not for the faint of heart. I mean, there's literally no minority or anything that's left untouched. I mean, but just to give you an example, I mean, I won't read anything objectionable, but if I take, like, the article on Windows, if we say down here, I'll just read a here we go, here's an excerpt. As it stands, Windows is a very reliable OS, provided users don't have hang-ups about their computer crashing every 5 seconds, randomly deleting their files, murdering their wives and catching fire.
Well, I must admit, I was struggling at the incredibly reliable OS. When you said that, I just thought, what planet are they on? But then it then qualified that statement, which is fine. I like it already, Jack. I'm loving it, man.
It's the most incredibly irreverent site I've ever come across. I mean, what I just said there, I mean, it just counts as, like, parody. But all the really funny stuff is, well, it's, a lot of it, is, like I say, is really offensive.
I didn't think that was parody, actually. I thought it was pretty accurate.
This is 100% true. Yeah.
That's just copied and pasted from Wikipedia, isn't it?
I I mean, I particularly like at the top of this article, it says, information, if you are homosexual, see Mac OS. If you do not shave and or shower, see Linux.
beard.
The point is that no group gets away unscathed. I mean...
It's even-handed.
It's completely
even-handed. It's got a bat in each hand and it's hitting everybody.
Very hard. It's sort of the complete opposite of PC. I mean, this site's been like taken down like a couple of times because of some of the content. I mean, some of the images on there alone. And like I say, you don't want to go in there if you're easily offended or even like, even if you're not keen on that sort of thing.
Probably not one to show your kids before they get into bed.
Absolutely not. But it's incredibly funny. And the reason I say why it's a subject kind of close to my heart is that it seems to be one of the few places on the internet where people can really write anything they want. If you know what I mean? It's completely... It feels like a... I mean, it sounds like a bit more grand than it possibly is, but it feels like a true home of free speech. I mean, there's stuff I read on there that I just don't read anywhere else. And I check it out and it's like, blimey, that's actually true. It's actually... There's truth between the multitudes of untruth and all the pictures of Hitler, Pokemon, and things like that.
Hitler, Pokemon. Oh wow!
So there's
well, obviously, at the moment, the topic of the day, or almost looks like the raison d'être of the site at the moment, is everything jobs Mac and so on and so forth. In very poor taste, Jack, I have to say.
Poor taste is the name of the game on this site.
It's the only site that I've seen taken down so many times, but still keeps coming back.
They just keep backing it up and they keep putting it up somewhere else.
Really? So what is it, the ISPs or the hosting providers that are taking it down, or the Secret Service or the FBI? Or
the first time, I believe it was that the main woman that ran the site, she sold the domain for... She was saying that, shock for shock's sake has become a bit old, so we're looking to move in new directions. She started up a new, deeply unpopular site. That was basically like Know Your Meme. And there's a lot of Know Your Meme. A lot of the humour here centres around like internet memes and like joke pictures taken from like everywhere they can seemingly find them. And the next time it went down, it was to do with the ISP dropped them. So they had to find a new one, and they found one, and they just keep backing up and taking it somewhere else. And then they usually put like a taunting message at the top saying, ha, we're back again.
Well, there's something kind of like, there's something endearing about that slightly kind of rebellious, you know, kind of stick the finger to the man kind of attitude. I can get with that.
That's exactly what it is. I mean, when you read the article about them like saying how great Nazis are and they should be encouraged in all their forms, you know they don't really mean it.
Yeah, it's...
Or maybe some of them do. There's thousands of people must be contributing to this thing. Maybe a few of them do mean it, but it's funny.
Well, yes. Well, I mean, as I said, it seems pretty much in the height of bad taste. But
unfortunately, that's the theme running throughout.
But there is, I mean, what I would say on this is, and not that I want to bring any kind of political aspect into this, but you know, I do actively encourage this kind of thing. And the reason why I say that is because just like bumholes, opinions are just like bumholes. Everybody has got one. And it doesn't make it valid.
And sometimes they stink.
Yeah, and sometimes they do stink, absolutely. And I think the thing about it is that we have to be very careful about this kind of PC stuff. Very, you know, we get stigmatised now all the time for being homophobic, being racist, being disability discriminatory. You know, we've gone almost the opposite way now, where almost you can't say anything, you can't speak about anything and have an open, frank discussion about something and just say something, put something out there because you're offending people and so on and so forth. And I worry about that. I almost see it as a kind of, almost the antithesis of censorship, where you say something and then you are ridiculed for saying it, is just the same as taping somebody up and effectively prosecuting them for it.
Sure.
So I think there's a freedom of speech aspect to that. Again, I can understand why people, equally, of course, some people would get very upset. I mean, you know.
Completely.
I just think it's harmless anarchy. And if you stop them from doing it in a harmless fashion, they're going to find another out there. You know,
yes.
Like, it's fun. It's harmless. Yep. If you don't like it, don't type in that exceedingly long URL.
Yeah.
No, you're not just going to accidentally stumble across this site. No. If you don't like it, don't read it.
Yeah.
That's right. I mean,
if you get into a fight with them, people are just going to... Yeah. Everyone's going to lose.
Yeah. Eh? It should be obvious quite quickly that it's not to be taken seriously.
Mm.
I mean, some of the articles, they fight with each other within the article. Like, one person will cross out what the last person has written and put their own bit, saying how stupid he was.
No, I encourage that. I think it's good. I think that obviously you have to take it for what it is, like you rightly say. I mean, completely. You know, obviously the lead page at the moment with our earlier conversation in the early part of the programme and me, you know, obviously my kind of blessing on Jobsy, to then see that at the end, sort of think, I was a little bit kind of rattling in the core a bit there and thinking, what?
Yeah,
but,
yeah, exactly.
But, you know, if you can step aside from the emotion, read it kind of in an objective way, then actually, yeah, it's got quite a lot of dark humour to it, hasn't it?
And when it comes to humour, there's like nothing sacred, I think, is the philosophy.
Mm.
I'm with my dad on this. He always says that there shouldn't be anything, no matter how serious, that you shouldn't be able to make fun of. You know what I mean?
And the thing is, you know, like you were saying about the front page, it's done that because they're kind of poking fun at that reaction. They're sort of, they know they shouldn't, and that's why it's that being done. You know, that's the fun of doing it, isn't it? It's kind of, this is the absolute worst thing I could say right now.
That's the fun of the front page. That's the fun of reading it. You feel like a little bit naughty for reading it, and you think, oh, this is fun.
But it is at heart. I don't think, you know, I think there's no harm in trying to do that, because you are trying to do that and not actually being horrible and offensive. Does that make sense?
It does. I think I was just looking for the sort of words to perhaps sum it up and or to say something about it. And I think that in some ways we can express the darkness in our lives through a kind of slanted humour like this. Mm. And if we take it in that way, sometimes issues that are really serious and quite emotional, being able to have a comic aspect to it and vent that through comedy is a natural thing, you know, and I think that that's a good thing.
Hmm. Has to be, yeah. So as I say, that's encyclopediadramatica.ch. Strange
for now.
until it changes, subject to further notice, yeah. But that'll be up on the website. Hopefully it'll still be available.
Might be interesting to take a very brief return to the Chrome App Store, see how that's evolving.
Yeah,
we did have a talk about it a couple of months ago, didn't we? And
mm-hmm.
It seemed to be kind of flooded with links. That's what I saw it as.
Oh, bookmarks.
Yeah, so you added the app, in quotes, to your Chrome desktop, and it says you need Chrome for this app to work if you're in another browser. So you open Chrome up, and you go, right, now I can install the app. A little dialogue pops down from the title bar saying what privileges it needs. You think this is all very sharp and professional. Installs the app to your app list. You think, pretty cool. You click on it, and you're forwarded to a flash animation on someone else's website.
Hell yeah.
I could have typed that URL myself in Safari, which you said it wouldn't work in. So let's see if it's evolved. I thought it might be interesting to look at what people are saying are the top apps at the moment on the Chrome App Store,
mm-hmm.
and see if they've got the experience right.
Sounds good. I mean, I know, just as an aside, but it is a run-to of this, I know that the Samsung Chrome OS laptop is now out in the market space. I haven't had an opportunity to get my hands on one yet, but the reports look pretty good. It's getting some pretty good reviews. You know, 4s out of 5s in Micromart and things like this. People like it.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's a good start. I think, you know, the bookmark thing, as you said, was kind of a bit ropey to start with, but in fairness, I think everything's going to be a little bit ropey to start with. As it's kind of, you know, yes, the technology's there, but again, the developer community's got to rally behind it, haven't they?
Yeah. This is just a little bit misleading, isn't it?
Mm.
You feel a little bit like you're trying to pull something here.
So this is TweetDeck. I'm not sure if you guys have used this at all, but I used to use the Air app.
Donkeys ago, I tried to install it with Air,
and I used it on my iPad for a while, but then the official Twitter apps came out, and I think they were, personally, I just thought they were better. So,
mm-hmm.
So I kind of dropped this multi-column interface. At first I thought it was great, because you got all the columns up, and then I thought, actually, I don't need Twitter to be full screen.
Mm-hmm.
I just want a little thing in the sidebar. So this is TweetDeck running in the browser. and it seems to be modelled very closely off the Air app.
It doesn't look like a browser app. It looks like the Air app, doesn't it, in fairness, the way that it's, you know, operating. It looks to me, my kind of reaction is, it looks to me like it's, HTML5, JavaScript and CSS. They're using the latest kind of technology to pull it together.
It's quite interesting. I just noticed on the right-click menu in Chrome, I can share this with TweetDeck.
Okay.
Even on a different tab. So, because TweetDeck is installed in my Chrome browser, now when I'm looking at this page, I can right-click, share with TweetDeck, and it goes back to my TweetDeck tab and puts a link to it in.
Even shortens the link, I see.
Okay, so that is definitely installing something into the Chrome browser, because each of the tabs in Chrome is a distinct and separate thread. All part of the security policy in Chrome. They're effectively isolated sandboxes for each tab. So that is definitely not just a kind of fancy bookmark.
Yeah, there's some sort of TweetDeck has told Chrome to add this to the right-click menu. And when you right-click on a different tab, that right-click tells Chrome to go back to TweetDeck as one of its apps and then send it a message. It's quite interesting. I wonder if it would work if... Let me close this TweetDeck tab a second and see if it's still there.
Yeah, it's still there.
Yeah, it is, okay. Yeah, and bang, look, it fires it up. That's pretty good.
That's truly a web app rather than a web
pop-up
page,
box.
Isn't it?
Look there. In the top right,
that's
like fired
cool
off a little
well.
Independent window.
Yeah, that's clearly outside of the browser window as well, isn't it?
And it triggered a OS sound as well, didn't it? It triggered the system bell or something there as well.
That's nice.
That's quite nicely
integrated,
isn't
it? The fact
you
can configure it to go where you like as well. I might put it back in the upper right corner.
That's quite slick, actually. I quite like that. I'd like to see... It'd be really interesting. I mean, on Linux, we have the open source version available to us, Chromium. Now, most of the Google, all of the Google Plus plugins and stuff for the Hangouts, etc., and the other things work on of it. I haven't played about with the Chrome App Store on it yet, but I will. I mean, looking at some of these apps are quite good.
So that's TweetDeck. Quite good.
Yeah, it's all very slick.
It is. No,
slick.
It's
it looks
not
like a proper
quite
desktop
good. I think it's very good. It's really impressive, that. I like that a lot.
Next up, we've got Avery's Image Editor. And this app, I guess, is kind of like Paint with a few bells and whistles on. I think that's probably a fair... As opposed to saying it's like Photoshop, but cut down.
Oh, sure, yeah. It's more basic than...
It makes me think like Paint.net, which is...
It doesn't make me think Paint. And I think that's because it's more image edity rather than kind of paint-y, where Paint I'd expect to see palettes and so on and so forth. I'm just trying to think... I mean, I wouldn't describe it as Photoshop at all, but you know, the fact that we've got some layers here, and it looks to me like it's definitely designed to... It looks like you should load an image into it.
I was
and
just
then
gonna
be able
try
to play
that.
About with it.
So if we...
Yeah, see if you can fire something into it and see whether it all...
Import this image.
It's all very impressive, considering this is all a browser app.
Oh, it's doing it. Oh, look!
So it's added it as a separate layer. That's quite interesting.
Okay.
There's a layer on top.
And then presumably, I can move that around.
Yeah.
Wow, that is pretty slick, isn't it?
It's all very responsive, isn't it? It's,
It is. It's got a real desktop feel to it, hasn't it?
Although it has committed the cardinal sin. It is a Flash application.
Oh, it's all Flash, is it?
You're doing me, Eddie, man.
They were doing so.
You're bad.
So we are actually at avery.com/online/image editor.
Yeah, which is an online Flash app. So no need to be restricted to Chrome here, boys and girls. You should go and do it in anything except Infernal Exploiter.
Don't believe the hype.
Thank you, but we'll leave you there.
Yeah.
SpringPad was another one that comes highly rated, and this uses the Google sign-on, so
when you've come from Chrome, you're already signed in.
OAuth, is it? Like OAuth API type stuff. Yeah.
Which is quite cool, so it knows who I am. And this is kind of a note keeping.
Okay.
App. So if we open up the first notepad, then okay. Here are some notes about how great at random was this evening. Just a bit of posterity there. And there we go. And then presumably this is using, and this is definitely HTML5, and presumably it's using some kind of local database. So if we took this offline, I didn't mess with the net connection because it's...
Well, it's through the eye of a needle with the packets this evening. It's all sort of a bit touch and go.
But it seems to hand notes and tasks, so you can add due dates to your tasks and then store them in this nice, friendly notebook.
Again, it's got a very desktop feel about it. You know, I mean, it doesn't look like a website. It doesn't feel like a website. Really behaves just like a nice little smooth app, isn't it?
What I find quite interesting, actually, by a lot of these HTML5 apps is they look quite a lot like Apple applications.
Maybe they look different on Windows.
They go for the rounded corners.
It's a very gradient style, background. Everybody wants to look like that, don't they? it's the friendly, clean layout that everybody craves.
It comes with a... So offline support, so you can use it without the internet, without local cache. Presumably the alerts will tell you of all your notes that are, sorry, your tasks that are outstanding. And there's a browser extension, so that you can access your account and save items anywhere. And presumably that will add a little button up here, so that you can access it without having to go to the page. Let's have a look.
Checkity check it.
Ooh. So that was installing it now. Yeah, and bang on, there it is, John. So install, a couple of settings later, there's a nice little browser extension.
That's quite nice. It's
cheeky
like a
little welcome message there.
And there it is, essentially. It's essentially a little iframe version, isn't it? But it means you don't have to open up a separate tab. It just dangles down here off your...
It's all kind of stuff that's been done before, but it's every effort's been made to make it feel like an app rather than a fancy bit of JavaScript.
Do you know, I'm watching this and I'm actually sitting here getting really quite excited about this. And the reason why I said, obviously, I have a lot of background in software as a service, application delivery, etc. And I'm looking at this and just thinking, if you've got like a Chrome OS notebook, you effectively have the ability to just kind of build the tool, whatever tools you need for the kinds of things you're doing. You know, if you want to do some image editing, knock some stuff up, you can do that. Maybe you need to do your social media stuff. You can just hook these things into the browser and you can effectively configure your desktop experience in an app setting way.
Sure.
Very much the way kind of, I mean, Lion is doing this. We were talking about earlier on about this easy to install apps. What they've got here in Chrome is that kind of Android install whatever you want experience, and it's. I mean, I'm impressed with this, John. This looks well. Have you got Jolly Cloud there? Did I just see Jolly Cloud?
Yeah. Let me.
Could you fire that up?
I didn't really.
Because this is an OS, a basic browser-based OS in itself. Unfortunately, you actually need a login. You need to be signed up for it to get the desktop experience.
I did sign in once. I don't remember what my credentials were. Maybe I logged in with... So it's a shame that this doesn't use the Google sign-on.
I like when things use the Google sign-on, yeah. It's kind of like a... it's just what we were saying about centralising things.
They should allow that, actually, because, I mean, they've done it with Facebook, which is effectively very similar API. There should be no reason why they can't do that.
I mean, you'd think that before you put your app on the Chrome Web Store, you would add the Google sign-on, because they're going to be signed in with it, because they're looking at the Web App Store.
So, yeah, Jolly Cloud, this is, again, like, well, it's almost Jolly Cloud's a bit like kind of iPad, an iPad typey experience with, you know, your various icons on the desktop that fire off different apps that you can play. Wow.
Space Invaders.
Check it out. Space Invaders is awesome.
While cool looking, it's just a flash.
Animation.
But it reminds me of the original
Space Invaders. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, Flash seems to be the common theme around here.
So this is a little bit weird, having Jolly Cloud within the App Store, because it's kind of like using the App Store to launch Jolly Cloud to launch another bookmark.
That is weird. I mean, I've got actually the Jolly Cloud OS installed on a VM on one of my machines. So basically it boots from the disk into Jolly Cloud. You log in and you've got this web OS that you see here. And it's actually, I mean, it's a very slick experience. Jolly Cloud OS is nice. It is very nice. In fact, actually, maybe I'll bring it in and I'll do a review of it, and I'll take you through it and show you around what it can do. It's pretty cool.
So just one or two more quick ones to look at before we conclude with how...
Whoa, what's that little audio gadget there? That looked like a little audio mixer thing.
I'm going to close Slide Rocket, because as much as I've tried, I just get nothing. A black screen. I think there's a slight gradient on it, but it's still a very dark screen.
Is that a flash?
That is a flash player link. So SpringPad was a definite win. And we've got a couple more here to look at. Which one?
I think you've got a kind... I guess it's like anything else, isn't it? It's a bit like the Android market space or the App Store, wherever, you know, at the end of the day, you're going to get some good stuff and some bad stuff. It's a case of going around and playing around with stuff. So, this is Weebly. Now, I've come across Weebly on the web before. It's a web, like a WYSIWYG, what you see is what you get, web editing tool. And I've come across some sites that have been made with it by some pretty much complete amateurs who have done some pretty good stuff. You know, it's not a bad old tool. Kind of template-driven and template and wizard-driven. But you can get a reasonable kind of, you know, hack together website out of it, and the results are not bad.
Weebly, the WYSIWYG web editing tool.
Yeah, try saying that after you've had three or four pints of you know, Devonshire cloudy cider.
So this is obviously linked off to their website, but it's used the Google sign-in, which is nice.
Yeah.
So seem to be stuck here at the create your website domain.
Thank you for your business.
It wants a choice: register a new domain or use your own domain. You're going to need to.
I've picked.
Oh right, you've
user
picked that.
Subdomain.
Oh right, okay, sorry.
I think it might just be the threading of the packets again, dodging the BitTorrent traffic down the wonderful road that we live in.
Now, well, it's raining outside. Of course, I wouldn't say it's torrenting down, but it is in one context, in that, you know, most of the students are probably torrenting down pirate DVDs straight from Hollywood. This is the trouble, I guess, with living in a student kind of area, when they all come back and get on the bandwidth pipe.
Yeah, that's it.
You've had it.
But is that going?
So this is actually a reasonably interesting way of highlighting one of my fears of the app, the Chrome App Store. If I had a Chromebook right now, I would not be a happy user if this is all I could use.
Yeah, your bandwidth. But, well, I mean, I think like anything else, I think for me, I'm not so concerned about that. I think most of the time, most people are getting reasonable bandwidth. I mean, obviously here today it's a bit of an issue. But
just not you, John.
When we talked about Chrome before, you know, HTML5 has and the Chrome browser has the ability to use local storage, local databases. The facility is there to cope with poor bandwidth. It's just really down to the app developers and app designers to kind of write that robustness in. And if they want people to use their apps, they're going to need to write that robustness in to give people a good experience. So I think it will come. Still early days for this, but it's improved massively. It's really coming along. I think it's time I got my finger out and got some of our apps up and available on there, for sure.
The question is, are there enough Flash experts to deal with our fears?
Oh, well, there's no need for that. You know what I mean? If you're still using Flash to develop and write stuff, then, you know, well, really, you deserve all you get. I don't know. And if you want my full and frank opinion, then I suggest you read Encyclopedia Dramatica.
Look up Flash.
You'd love what they've got to say about Linux users.
Well, oddly enough, I the bits that I did see on there, I thought largely they were right. It didn't strike me as being very satirical at all. Pretty much accurate.
So we have two more to look at before we call it a day with the Chrome App Store. We've got 280 slides, which is a bit of a PowerPoint clone.
This looks pretty much PowerPoint, doesn't it? Yeah.
And this isn't running in Flash. Nice to know.
So, first question is, will it import open documents out or Microsoft or none of them?
Let's have a quick check.
See what it can do. Put this mother through its paces, John.
Oh, Chrome has crashed.
Whee!
No, is the answer.
Google Chrome has quit unexpectedly. We'll try that one more time, shall we?
It wouldn't happen in Flash. If the guy had known what he was doing.
When you say it wouldn't happen in Flash, do you mean like the other apps we've looked at there where they just nothing happened and it
nothing
didn't
would happen
work
in Flash?
That's what you meant. I wanted to be clear, yeah, nothing would happen in Flash.
Let's give that another go. Here we are.
So here we go. I've clicked on the import button. I'm now given the option to select some type of file. I'm going to assume it's looking for a PowerPoint file.
So if you'd have find yourself something by Microsoft.
I don't know where any of these things are.
Yeah, try it with there was a PPTX there. Try it with one of those babies.
Sounds kind of hardcore, doesn't it?
Well, listen, don't knock it, PPTX. It's the, it's Microsoft's OOXML. It's an open format. And the standard specification is only 6,000 pages, so it's, you know, easy to get on board with the OpenXML development standard.
I'm suspicious of any file extension that's more than three letters. What was the longest one? Do you remember PaintShop Pro and its PSP image as a file extension? Literally, PSPIMAGE was all after the dot.
Here we go. We'll take the ITAM keynote.
Hell yeah.
Okay.
Importing from C, fake path, ITAM keynote.
That's interesting.
It's obviously, I mean, it's interesting to note we're doing this on a Mac, so I suspect that there are one or two things that work better on Windows.
Weren't able to complete your upload. The students are nicking all the bandwidth.
I wonder if it was that or the strange fake path.
You're into
maybe we should give
territory.
It the benefit of the doubt, and perhaps it just can't thread the presentation through the eye of a needle. Our 1440 board modem.
It's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than it is to get a Chrome app to run all the way through.
But without the import feature, it does actually bear a very striking resemblance to PowerPoint.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, for all the world, yeah, it looks like PowerPoint at a glance.
And I'm more impressed when I get to say that and it's not a Flash app. I think that's a...
You just used Comic Sans, John. Everybody listening to use Comic Sans.
Yeah.
It's such a stunning font.
Right up on Encyclopedia Dramatica.
It's a key font.
We should look that up on Encyclopedia Dramatica.
Comic Sans.
Comic Sans. Yeah, I wonder what they have to say about that.
So yeah, I mean, it's pretty good.
Well, overall, I think it's fairly impressive. So maybe if you're listening out there and you haven't gone and had a play around with Chrome and Chrome apps, then do so. I think it's worthwhile spending an hour just fiddling around with it and seeing what it can do. I think that most users, if you're used to a standard browser experience and you get your hands on that, I think you'll have a lot of fun, and I think you'll be pretty impressed with what it can do.
I'd be really excited to see what it's like in a few months' time.
Yeah, absolutely.
As the apps develop more.
Jackson, in this little seg, can we have the final word from Encyclopedia Dramatica on Le Comic Sans? What's the word on the street?
what they have to say on Comic Sans, all written in Comic Sans, I might add. It says, Comic Sans is only the greatest font ever. EVAROMG.
Awesome.
Well, that brings yet another show of At Random to a tearful end.
A tearful end, yeah, absolutely. I think a little bit of a somber note there in the show. But do remember to get in touch with us and let us have your opinions and your views. Email us show@random.com. Email us show@random.org.
Ding.
We're so professional from start to finish.
Nothing more professional than picking each other up when we fall down, is there?
Quite right, yeah.
Well, thank you for listening. We hope you check out our website. And I've been John Wordsworth.
I've been Rick Timmis.
Rick Timmis.
Thank you, man. And I'm I knew I'd forgot something.
And I'm Jackson Matthews, reminding you to stick it to the man with Comic Sans.
And we'll be leaving you this evening with another track from Magnatune, and it's Soul Print Aesthetic.
Step outside myself to feel the things that I do, but I can't help myself. But I am not but you. You can't kill yourself, 'cause you're dead in my fucking head. Lying the one that you want, but what you want so unreal. Well, I'm gonna tell everyone, well, I'm gonna every day. I am the one that you want, I'm gonna hold you the flame.
I just find it quite ironic that here we are getting set up for the show again, and we're all kind of struggling with the old bandwidth. The students are kind of raiding everything. And anyway, it gave me an idea for the show title, really. And I thought to myself, yeah, okay, show 10, through the eye of a needle. Because like threading packets through an eye of a needle, aren't we, with the amount of bandwidth we've got at the moment? It's just like...
This is the tech version of Student Riots in Exeter.
Yeah, it
is. They're not on the street burning the shops down. They're on BitTorrent using all our bandwidth.
Yeah, they are on BitTorrent and iPlayer and whatever else it is.
suppose they could be burning stuff down out there, but we're too busy trying to.
Maybe they are. Maybe that's what they do. Maybe they're burning the fibre. They're pulling it up out of the road and stripping the burning the copper off to take it up to the scrapyard.
Beating pollution with lengths of it. Yeah.
Where was it? There was somewhere in the world where they were doing that. They were trying to put. I think it might be in Africa or one of these nations where they were trying to put broadband in. And they'd lay the copper cables 1 week, and then they'd come back and somebody had dug them out of the ground and had a fire to burn all the plastic off it, and then oink the copper away. No broadband for you, like, nicking the copper.
This is what happens when you put the horse before the cart. You give them fibre optic cables and stuff before you give them enough money to live on.
Yeah, exactly, that's right. They come and nobody can rub 2 shillings together to get a cheese sandwich, but they've got 100 megabit fibre broadband.
See, I'll have that to feed my family. Much obliged.
Yeah, and of course, they've got all the computers to do it. They've got second-hand 386s that we've shipped over there in skips that only connect over RF Ethernet. So, you know, the broadband's great, but it's only, you know, Mr. Mugabe himself.
So wait until the students come back and then
yeah.
So here we go, through the eye of a needle.
Yeah, awesome.